Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC. So Make America Great Again rallied millions to the polls. But our next guests say America was already reinventing itself. Our Towns is a new book from husband and wife co-authors James and Deborah Fallows. James is a veteran national correspondent for The Atlantic, as many of you know, and going way back was a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. Deborah is a linguist and author. Together, they say the country is improving in ways we wouldn't believe here in New York and don't hear much about in the media because we're too focused on politics and not enough on the changes in the economy and our notions of community that are happening on the ground. Over a five-year period, the pair resided in dozens of towns that captured people's attention when something bad occurred, like being struck by a natural disaster or the loss of a big employer. And watching these communities rebuild has given the Fallows genuine hope. It's good timing because we could all use some, no matter who you voted for president, some hope that is. The book that chronicles their journey is called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. James and Deborah, welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's so nice to talk to you again.
You started putting this book together in 2012. I'll call it the year 2012 BT, before Trump. Why then, Deborah?
We were out to see America. We had been in China for a number of years before that and came back and wanted to see for ourselves what the country was feeling like town by town. The national narrative was a bit dark. Our impressions from flying around in our little plane, which we had done for 20 years nearly by that point, was that out in the communities around the country that things were going actually quite well, and they were very interesting. So we wanted to revisit a lot of these towns and new towns to see what the pulse of the nation was, town by town.
And did you get a sense, James, that there were deep grievances about the direction of the country before Trump was elected that maybe made you less surprised by his election than some other people might have been? Or that maybe that's the opposite of your narrative, which is that a lot of places where we think things aren't going so well, maybe they are.
We actually had a different view of the Trump election and its interpretation than I think was the normal media reaction right after that news in November of 2016. And there's a point of personal privilege I need to exert here that on the Making America Great front, after we lived in Japan, I wrote a book called More Like Us about how America needed to react to Japan by refinding American values. Its subtitle was Making America Great Again. Huh. Say, where's my hat? But I think that our view was—
Where's your patent lawsuit?
where's my seat in the White House? I think that our interpretation, many people said, oh, gee, if only you had been, quote, out there, unquote, in the run-up to the election, you would have seen the rage and fury and despair that was expressed by Donald Trump. We think that was a misinterpretation that, in fact, most people, when they thought about national politics, they did indeed have these polarized reactions. But if you ask people, as we did in Western Kansas or Mississippi or South Dakota or upstate New York, whether things within their range of experience, their towns, their communities, their schools were getting better or worse, most of them felt the direction was positive.
On issues like race relations, the treatment of immigrants, very interested in that one, religious tolerance, where Muslims live, and other divisive issues, does America look different from what it feels like in the national media, Deborah?
I think it does look different. We started to say to each other that the more you got into towns with large number of immigrants and refugees, the less you heard about the disruption and the entanglements and the build the wall comments. That towns that had large populations of immigrants or refugees were working very hard to embrace them, to bring them in as foundations of their economy, to make them comfortable in the schools, to make them American citizens. And we found that the kind of byword that was going on in those towns was, we need each other. The locals would say that to the refugees, and the refugees would say that back.
Still just the times.
And let's take some of the examples. San Bernardino is one in the LA area. And, you know, that's a place that's gone through its share of pain. Obviously, maybe the most immediate reaction that people have in this area to just saying the name San Bernardino these days is the mass shooting that took 14 lives a few years ago.
Sure. And San Bernardino has always had a different connotation to me because I grew up right across the border in the town of Redlands. So I've known it my entire life. It's always been, in the California perspective, a majority, minority, troubled, blue-collar place that has lost a lot of industries. And so there, by necessity, you have transracial alliances because that's what San Bernardino is. And we argue that they're really from a low abyss, that they are moving forward. Perhaps more surprising were places like Dodge City, Kansas, which is, you know, familiar from Gunsmoke, but it's now a majority Latino population through migration for the meatpacking industry and other things. And there, a still mainly white business leadership and electorate has passed tax levies to improve the schools that have mainly Latino children there. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a mainly white settlement, has become one of the main places for absorbing refugees, largely from Sudan, Somalia, Congo, et cetera. So through American history, immigration has always been disruptive. But if you didn't hear the national rhetoric, we're saying that city by city would look as if it was proceeding the way it has over the years.
I'm going to throw in a news alert here. The New York Times is now reporting that President Trump has told French President Macron that the U.S. will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. This is according to a person briefed on the conversation, according to the New York Times. So far, we just have it from the Times, not other news sources, but the Times is usually credible enough that we're passing that along. And we will carry Trump's scheduled announcement at 2:00 on our website. We will stream live at WNYC.org Trump's statement about what the United States is going to do with respect to the Iran nuclear agreement at 2:00 this afternoon, again at WNYC.org. Deborah, one of the cities that you visited in the book, actually the largest city that you visited, was Columbus, Ohio, capital of Ohio. They're having primary elections today in the state of Ohio, and obviously a bellwether for what happens in American politics. Why was Columbus one of your destinations?
Columbus was a destination for a number of reasons. First, it's my home state. I grew up in Vermilion, Ohio, which is north of that on the lake. And we wanted to visit a variety of towns. Mostly we were going to smaller and middle-sized towns, but we did include a couple of them that were larger than that. And we wanted to go to Rust Belt states, and we wanted to go to states that had towns that had an interesting narrative. Columbus itself is a great combination of a collaborative town. There's so much collaboration among the politicians, the public institutions, the private industry, that they've had to shorten the word collaborate to two syllables. They just say they collab with each other. And of course, it has the Ohio State University. So we found in Columbus wonderful examples of collaboration. For example, there's a high school right next to the main Columbus City Library, and the librarian says, "You all don't need a library in your high school. You can just come and use ours in the town." And they send the kids in that high school off to internships one day a week to 20 or 30 of the private industries, hospitals, insurance companies, for internships to train them on how to get professional skills and a foot into the business community. And these are urban city school kids. So you've got those kinds of collaborations going on that we wanted to see.
And there's one other part of the Columbus drama that was interesting in addition to what Deb is saying, which is that they had a real crisis, as the country did after the financial crash of 2008-2009. And the mayor at the time, Michael Coleman, a very powerful, popular mayor, he recently has left office, he told the citizens of his town, "You can either pay more taxes while your businesses are failing, while you're being laid off, or we're going to have to eviscerate the city's public services." And he convinced the electorate to raise their taxes in 2009 in the teeth of the recession, and they all think that it has paid off in the long run.
I guess when you visited Garden City, Kansas, it was before the governor of Kansas lowered taxes and tried that super supply side experiment that backfired in the other direction.
Yes, but we were in Dodge City, Kansas after that, near Garden City, and where because the Sam Brownback absolutism at the state level was choking their schools, the people in Dodge City voted a levy to increase their school funding locally. Again, it's a mainly Latino school population now, mainly white electorate.
Is there a generational divide, Deborah, in the way Americans are working toward improving their futures?
It's a great question. And Erie, Pennsylvania, I think, is a good example of an answer to that, where General Electric was a major employer for forever and has since moved much of their manufacturing to Fort Worth, Texas. And the older part of the population was disgruntled, dismayed, distraught, anything that begins with a dis attached to it. The younger part of the population was, okay, we never wanted to work at GE anyway. We're tired of this naysaying here. We're here to make our lives in Erie, so we're going to be part of the new tech economy. We're going to do startups of graphic design. And we're going to start an alt-weekly newspaper. We're going to build up this library to welcome everyone and have free Wi-Fi and a maker space. So you do understandably get this kind of disconnect between the younger and older generation, but the optimism the older half will time out, the younger half will keep going and work to build those towns.
Is there a difference between the two of you? I've been told that there is, in the degree of optimism you have about the future?
There's a difference there's a difference in a million ways between us. There's a difference in the way we express our optimism about the future. Deb, perhaps you would like to illustrate this.
Okay. I am the absolutist. Everything seems great. Where I see grass growing green, it's bright green. And Jim brings a historical perspective on this, that things come and go in cycles. Yes, it's true that there is a lot of we can't ignore the bad things that are going on. We are here to report more on what we have found in the positive. Jim, would you like to take that?
Yes. So America has lots of problems now. Everybody's aware of them. The opioids are the worst, but there are problems all across the country. And our main discovery and news to us and passion is that most people, most places think they're moving forward rather than backward, even places like San Bernardino, even places in Mississippi.
How does that inform the desperation that seems to be reflected in the election result?
I think that, trying to understand exactly what happened in this past election will be like the 2000 election, where 1,000 things had to go in a certain direction for to get the result that we had. There's been a constant of sort of disgruntlement in the American electorate. When Herbert Hoover was running in 1932 in the teeth of the Depression, he got 40% of the vote against FDR. I mean, there are these long-term grievances and dislocations and a real phenomenon of industrial change. But the U.S. has been through them many times before, including in our lifetimes.
Do you have a 20-second thought, Deborah, as a linguist, about anything you heard that was verbally really interesting?
Yes, I do. So I meet you at a party, and after saying, how do you two, then comes the second question. And we first paid attention to this in Greenville, South Carolina, which is, where do you go to church? If you ask anyone in St. Louis, it's, where'd you go to high school? In New York and Washington, it's, what do you do? In Denver, it's, what do you do? But they mean, do you hike? Do you ski? Do you skate? In L.A., it's, how'd you get here? Well, I took the 10 to the 405.
Ha. The book is called Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America by James and Deborah Fallows. And if you want to see them in person, you can do that at the Brooklyn Public Library at 7:30 tonight. They'll be in conversation with James Bennett, editorial page editor of The Times, in the Dweka Auditorium at the main branch of the Brooklyn Public Library. That's 10 Grand Army Plaza. You can reserve a spot, if you like, through the library's website, which is bklynlibrary.org. So great to see you in person, James, after your many phone appearances.
Thanks
Let's keep
so
talking.
Much, Brian.
Deborah, so great to see you. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Brian.